welcome to episode 124 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including Pez dispensers. I am Daniel Winter.
And my name is Mark Iwasa, and once again, we're very pleased to be joined by a special guest, this time Daniel Newman from New Mill Industries. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you. It's very cool to be here.
Awesome. And of course, that leads right into our conundrum of the night is there's going to be two Daniels on the show. I used to run a show with two Marks, which was confusing, but we have different accents in play here. So I think the listeners should be fine. But for my sake, I'm just going to call you your first names, if that works for you.
Yeah, that's fine.
We're both used to being one of our multitudes of Daniels out there. So absolutely.
Popular name, I suppose. And since you're our special guest, Daniel Newman, well, we're going to talk about New Mill in a bit, but maybe you can just tell us a little bit about where you sit on the Omnigamer spectrum, tabletop, RPGs, video games, whatever you like.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I used to be kind of a hardcore Euro player and nothing else. And then I discovered or rediscovered trick-taking games in the last few years, which I'm sure we'll be talking about a lot in this episode. And that's become kind of my exclusive play preference. But then I have been getting kind of other stuff, some lighter party games and other things. So it's more about experience for me at this point than like strict kind of categories of games. And I play some video games and stuff too, but not a whole lot. So yeah, I'm sure we'll get to a lot of it. This episode.
Excellent. Yeah, we've got lots to talk about. Three courses of games coming up, and we had a few sort of overlapping topics that we're going to get to today. But starting out with the appetizer, I thought, Daniel, would be a good excuse for you to talk a little bit about what you've been doing over at New Mill Games.
Yeah, absolutely. So New Mill Industries, folks who don't know, is a very small publisher. It's just me. I've been doing it for just over 5 years now, which is pretty exciting. We started out doing... Well, it was me and Tony Miller, another designer, who folks might know from...
Kabuto Sumo.
Yeah, Kabuto Sumo. Mm. And then he was on a podcast with Ian Zhang and... Oh, Gil Hova, of course.
Right.
Where they would talk about game design. He was on that for quite a while. But so Tony and I, it was in the middle of... Or just the beginning of the pandemic lockdowns. We were feeling kind of isolated and alienated from the board game scene since we used to go to a lot of conventions and we would meet up there. And I think it was actually Tony's idea that maybe we should try like publishing small games and starting with a couple of hours that we had pitched a bunch and gotten really good feedback from publishers, but they didn't quite fit what they were looking for. So we took a couple of those early designs that earlier designs that we felt pretty confident would work. And those were our first couple designs. And then we did a couple other small games from a couple of our friends. And then after like a year or so, things opened back up again. Tony got very busy with his job, and I realized that I could do a lot of the stuff myself if I switched to much simpler to produce games like trick-taking games. Mm. And around that time, I kind of rediscovered trick-taking and got exposed to the Japanese trick-taking scene, especially like Taiki Shinzawa. And I wound up making contact with him through Twitter, and he allowed me to publish two of his games that were out of print. And that kind of kicked off this kind of latest iteration of New Mill Industries, where I've just been doing trick-taking games, a lot of them from Japan, but then a bunch from US designers I found that are doing trick-taking in a very similar style. So that's been really exciting. I've done, oh gosh, I mean, I have like 20 games in inventory right now, and there are a few that have gone out of print. So I've published something like 30 or 40 games at this point, which is pretty wild. Over the last 5 years.
Yeah, very cool. I mean, we've spoken a little bit about some of your designs, including Gachapon Trick recently in our trick-taking episode. So obviously, New Mill does publish some of your own games, but you also curate a lot of other games as well. Is it just limited to trick-taking right now, or are you exploring other sort of card games?
Pretty much trick-taking and like climbing shedding games.
I was going to say, like, do you define ladder climbing? What was it? Ladder climbing? Shedding?
Yeah, climbing, shedding, ladder climbing. Yeah.
I can't remember what you call that subgenre of trick-taking.
there are differences. They're kind of related. I will tend to lump them in because fans of one tend to be fans of the other, not exclusively. Yeah, so I kind of lump them together as like a mutual interest. Yeah, and what I've done has been strictly that, partly because there's a built-in audience for it, and I know that there are people excited about constantly getting new trick-taking games that will buy like the stuff that I'm putting out. And it's a little riskier to kind of diverge from that. Although one of my recent designs, Folio, is only kind of loosely trick-taking. It's almost more of a set collection game that uses like trick-taking as a structure.
We've seen some trick-taking games that have started to lean on sort of maximalist design aesthetic, shall we say, like Bezier, for example, adding a lot of, like, a much bigger for what you would normally expect from a trick-taking game. But yours really do take advantage of getting a lot out of just a deck of cards. Basically.
Absolutely.
You don't,
maybe
most of your games
of
don't
tokens.
Even include anything else.
No, and that's part of how I'm able to, like, the business model works because I keep it low. Because all of my print runs are, like, typically 500 units, which is a lot smaller than most publishers are doing. And I had to find a factory that would even run them at that quantity, because most want you to do, like, 1,000 or 1,500 copies minimum. So my costs are a bit higher. My margins are a lot thinner. So I try to keep things as minimal as possible just to keep those costs down. Because the more profit there is, the more I can pay the designers, right? Because it's like a percentage on profit. So yeah, it's all trying to find that sweet spot.
And is there anything special you look for in a trick-taking game? I mean, I have to imagine, I mean, that there are, you know, so many hundreds of them out there. It feels like it would be diminishing returns as to finding something truly unique in the genre. So what makes one stand out to you?
Yeah, it definitely has to be doing something interesting that I haven't seen before. I like games that are kind of playing with the formulas that you would normally see in a trick-taking game. It's a hard thing to, like, describe. You just kind of know it when you see it, right? But yeah, if I play something that makes me go, oh, wow, I haven't seen this, or, oh, that made me feel really clever, or that made me feel really dumb, I want to figure out how that works. Those are all things that'll kind of get my attention. I've got a game that I'm doing this next year that the original version, it was a Japanese game, and instead of cards, it used colored cubes that you draw from a bag, and you're putting those on, and then you do have a set of cards that are just numbers, but you're basically making the cards you're playing by taking the card and then a colored cube that you've randomly gotten and assigning that. Kind of, if you think like Cat in the Box, where you're saying like, this is a red 5, but you only have like 1 through 12, and then you're putting the red on that number, and so now that's a red 4, right? And other people can play that red 4 later, potentially. But so imagine doing that, but you're also bidding on how many tricks you're going to take after you pulled your cubes, and everybody has the same set of numbers. Like, just crazy stuff like that starts to kind of play with the conventions and expectations.
They really do build upon what's come before. It's hard to jump into some of these more advanced trick-taking games blind, right?
Yeah, and everything I've done, like, I don't explain what trick-taking is in the rule books, because I assume the people who found me know what they're getting into for the most part, or have been introduced to my games from somebody who knows. And I've always kind of just approached it that way. Like, that is my market, is people who are really into trick-taking and are looking for, like, more weird stuff.
So there's a question that we were discussing on our trick-taking episode. What would you recommend as a starting trick-taking game?
Well, okay. There's starting, and then there's getting into, like, the weirder ones. if you've never played a trick-taking game...
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Hearts and Spades... are both great places to start.
That was my suggestion,
yeah. And they're both, I mean, they're also a little strange. Like, something like Oh Hell or Whist is going to be, like, your most basic, but Hearts is a cool intro to trick avoidance, which is kind of a subgenre of trick-taking where you're trying not to take specific tricks, but the trick play is very straightforward. Spades is great because it's a partnership game and you're introduced to bidding. And because it's bidding with a partner, there's a little bit of wiggle room. You don't have to be as exact. And then there's, like, the taking sandbags system lets you be a little off, and it's not super punishing unless you keep doing it.
I didn't grow up with trick-taking games in my community, but I learned the rules for Hearts recently, and I was surprised at how, like, modern the rules feel, especially because it's got a lot of qualities that are kind of unusual, like negative points, avoiding a certain suit. Like, those are kind of like degrees of friction that you don't see in a lot of casual or common card games, especially trump card games, classic card games. So I was surprised to see that. And as we discussed on the other episode, my first trick-taking game was Seiji Kanai's Chronicle,
okay,
which is kind of like a very very off the wall, non-typical one. So
also some powers and stuff in that one, right? With the different cards,
different win conditions every round, and a few small tokens in there. But I still enjoy that one quite a bit.
Yeah, the negative points thing is funny because a lot of like really old, much older, like traditional trick-taking games that maybe come from Germany or other places in Europe will have more friction and can be pretty brutal in the scoring. So, but yeah, the US kind of casual play. Yeah, I can see how it might feel a little hard-edged compared to some other stuff.
So you mentioned going to Japan. I know that you've gone to Japan recently for Tokyo Game Market. Happens twice a year. I don't know if you go twice a year.
I do.
But I know you've been going every now and again. Did that start before you decided to publish some Japanese trick takers or after the fact? What was the kind of your transition into Japanese games?
It was after, actually. So I'm trying to remember the timeline of it now. So I went to Essen, I think, in 2019. And going there, I realized I was most interested in the kind of the Asian game section, the stuff coming from Korea and Taiwan and Japan. And at that point, I was like, oh, maybe what I should really do is go to Tokyo Game Market, because I had just found out about it around the same time. And then I started getting into the Japanese trick takers, and I looked into it, and I realized, I also found out about how people were importing games from Japan, you know, post Game Market. And I was like, well, if I go and I buy an extra suitcase while I'm there, I can fill that suitcase with games and bring them back and sell them, and then I can make the money that would pay for the trip. And it worked, and I've done it the last four game markets at this point. And I'm actually leaving for Japan again in 10 days.
Oh, wow.
And I'll a lot of the small publishers and designers kind of know me now. And I could just reach out to them on Twitter or whatever and be like, hey, can I get 30 copies of your game? And like, yeah, and here's a discount. Because I know, you know, and I've explained to them, like, I buy them from you. I bring them back. I sell them on my website. And I'm going to mark it up. So I make a little money. And they're like, yeah, it's totally fine. But because I've built these relationships, like, it's become pretty frictionless. But that took a while to kind of, like, get known around the game market. And I get recognized now. And people ask me to sign autographs. And it's bizarre. But yeah, so that's another thing that I do with Numill, which I should have mentioned earlier, was that I when I go to Japan, I bring back a bunch of stuff and I make them available for people to purchase on my website. And they tend to sell out within minutes because I can only bring back so much. But yeah, it's another component of what I've been doing is trying to bring more of the stuff from Japan here. As well as I've had some of my games signed with Japanese and Korean companies, so they're being sold in Japanese in stores in Japan also, which is wild.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear. So do you basically show up there and then try and strike up kind of arrangements or
beforehand? No. It's all arranged way before. So usually what happens with Tokyo Game Market, have you been to Tokyo Game Market or not?
I haven't. It would be my pleasure to go, but I've just not coordinated the times of the years.
Gotcha. So what usually happens with the game market is folks will start posting what they're going to be selling a month or two before the show, and then about a month right before, they'll post links so you can make reservations. And you'll fill out a Google form, and you'll say what you want, and then they'll hold a copy for you on the day. And you'll know how much it costs and where their booth is, and you just go and you tell them, I have a reservation, you give them your name, and then you can buy your game. As long as you show up before 2 p.m. on the day you've reserved, and then they release it for anybody to buy. And that's kind of the general system. That's how, like, I pretty much reserve everything in advance. And then with folks that I'm buying multiples of, I definitely reach out to them directly, usually via Twitter, and say like, hey, you know, I'm going to be at Game Market. Can I get, you know, 30 copies of your newest one? And they're like, yeah, sure, no problem. Just pay me cash in the day. There've been a couple people that I've been able to pay in advance, which is nice because everything is cash on the day. And that's just a lot of money to be carrying around. So when I can make those arrangements, that's always a nice thing. But no, it's all, everything is, so like all I do is when I get there, I just show up and I make all my stops. I give money and I get games and then I put them in the booth that lets me store my stuff and then I have the rest of the day to kind of wander. But
Led to believe that Tokyo Game Market is quite different from what people would expect from an American games convention. Perhaps you could speak a little to that. I was listening to another podcast recently. I can't remember which it was. Maybe you were guesting on that. I don't recall. But someone was saying that basically, a lot of the games are just sold out of baggies, basically. Not even boxed games.
There is a section called the Yokocho, which is like an alley. This is a cultural reference in Japan, but there are these alleys. I don't know if you've heard of like Kabukicho, which is this famous like night spot in Shinjuku, I think. We're just alleys of all these little bars, right? So they have this section in Tokyo Game Market called the Yokocho, where it's people who haven't made full products and they're just selling like a deck of cards in a baggie. And oftentimes it's like a first, like a beta version of their game, and they'll bring it back the next Game Market or the one after with like a nice production, but you can get to see like they haven't quite finished it, or it's mostly there, they've done the packaging, so they
early
do have
access
those
for card games.
Yeah. and there's rules if you're in that area, and I think it's probably a lot cheaper to buy a table in that area, that you're not allowed to have a box. Like, it's just against the rules to have a box, so it's a lot of like sheets of paper printed out and stuck in a baggie, and that's it, or like maybe a small deck of cards. But yeah, most of the tables are what you would expect as a finished game, but it's also like almost feels more like a really big flea market in terms of that you don't have huge booths for most of the game market the way you would expect at a US game convention. It's really just like a table that sometimes is split with two designers and they've got maybe a small display of their games, but it's really just like the one designer and maybe their friend selling their own game.
Yeah, to my understanding, it's sort of part and parcel of this Japanese phenomenon of the doujin. So there's within various media, not just games, but particularly Tokyo, I actually don't remember the name, Comiket, the comics doujin indie comic market. In Japan, you're allowed to make indie comics of licensed properties up to a certain point. So there's like looser, I guess, copyright laws that way. So you might get indie comics, some of them erotic, not all, but of known properties like Pokemon or, I don't know, Pretty Cure or something like that. And there's entire conventions set up. So like at Tokyo Big Side or whatever, one of the big convention halls. So there's those for comics. There's those for often fashion, stationery, even like vinyl toys, like collector's toys that way. And I, to my understanding, Tokyo Game Market is kind of the extension of that doujin philosophy for tabletop games. And it's kind of inspiring to see. It's like, it's not an industry.
Right.
It's like literally creator to fan or creator to creator, which is cool to see.
There are, I mean, you know, there's a big like CMON Japan booth. There are a few companies that have larger booths, but like I would say 80 to 85% of the floor space are these doujin creators, right? Who sometimes are just making games for their friends, like just to have a thing that they worked on. So, but yeah, it's and everybody's really appreciative if you actually buy their game. They're like, oh my God, yeah, that's great. Thank you. Especially like this white guy showing up out of nowhere and be like, why are you buying my game? That's amazing. So that's kind of fun too.
Yeah, it's kind of cool because what you're describing about how you're treating the other game makers sounds very much like what the Japanese game makers do with each other's games, is support it, follow it on social media, spread it out a little bit. Just like reciprocity and respect, right? Just support each other's creations, which is
there's a lot of that. If you follow any of the like Japanese game designers, they're always sharing each other's stuff, like the friends of theirs, and it feels very much like, you know, board game Twitter used to be in back in the day before the exodus.
Right. But I had another question about, I noticed that with, I think it was Gashapon Trick, and with your forthcoming game, Yonkai no Yokai, that you have been collaborating with a kind of pretty well-known Japanese illustrator, Sai Beppu. And I was wanting to know a little bit more about how you work together. How do you, you know, how do you communicate with each other? How has that process been?
Yeah, Sai has become a friend over the last few years. I'm not exactly sure how it happened or started, but we talk to each other on Discord fairly often, and I've been out to visit her in Kyoto and played some games there. And yeah, I wind up spending time just kind of hanging out with her when at Game Market when she's not busy. Gachapon trick actually started, I don't remember what we were doing. Oh, we had gone to, she took me to this giant Bandai Gachapon store in Ikebukuro.
Yeah.
And so we went to this aquarium. She knew I liked octopuses, and there was an octopus at this aquarium. She's like, oh, I'm going to take you to this aquarium. And then she was like, oh, I heard you also like Gachapon. We should go to this store. And so it was us and then a couple of other Japanese designers. And we went to the Gachapon store, and I basically like just wandered off, and she had to come find me because everybody else was ready to leave. And I was like, I could have been there another hour. Like, I was just in Gachapon heaven.
It's massive. It's the insane. Largest.
Yeah.
It's got like 6,000 machines or something.
It's ridiculous. And so it was like, it was kind of embarrassing because everybody was standing by the door, like waiting to leave. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, sorry. She's like, oh, have you made your decisions yet? I'm like, oh. So, yeah. So, and then I started joking that I should design a game, a trick-taking game about Gachapon, because I'm now obsessed with Gachapon. And she was like, oh, and I'll illustrate it. I was like, oh, that's awesome. And then I was at the airport waiting to come home from Tokyo on that trip, and I started writing down ideas. I was like, I know how to design this game. And then I reached out to her, and I was like, if I design the game, do you want to illustrate it? She's like, absolutely, I do. And then I just decided like we would share the profits on it, because we were joking about, you know, the game before it became a thing. I was like, well, this is our idea. Like, we should do it together. And then with Yonkai no Yokai, it was a similar situation where, like, I was like, I came up with some, there was a joke about, so the reason it's called that is because the word for fourth floor is yonkai, which sounds a lot like yokai, especially when you hear it on the elevator, because it announces the floors, right? And a friend of mine was like, he heard the fourth floor, he's like, oh my god, are there monsters on this floor? Because yokai is like, you know, spirits or monsters in Japan. And then I was talking to her about it, and she thought it was really funny, and then I was like, oh, I have an idea for this game. And she was like, oh, I really want to draw yokai. I was like, all right, let's do it. And then, so it just kind of happens that way. But yeah, we've just developed this kind of very casual friendship just around trick-taking games. That's really all there is to it.
That's super cool. I really like her art from the original copy of Nana.
Mm-hmm. I know there's
multiple different editions, but just beautiful animal art. Now, my last burning question about your Japan-related games is, where does the toilet frog come from?
One of my very first Gachapon toys I got was Koi Man on the toilet. And I didn't know anything about it, but I saw this machine, and there was this like man with a goldfish head sitting on a toilet. And he had other poses as well, because Gachapon, often you have like a series of like six or seven things. And I was like, oh, I really hope I get that weird one on the toilet. And I did, and I was so excited. And I was like, this has to be one of the toys in Gachapon Trick. Like, she's like, well, I don't want to get in trouble for IP infringement, so it's not going to be Koi Man. So she decided to do a frog instead. So yeah,
it was definitely the favorite gacha when we were playing our last game at Daniel's place.
I did get some Gachapon fever when I was back in Sydney recently, and they've really exploded over there. A lot of Gachapon parlors have popped up.
Awesome.
And just on hand, I have my Yokai.
Oh, very nice.
I can't remember what type this is exactly.
Oh, I don't know that. There's so many. I don't even know. But no, I'm a little obsessed with Gachapon. And one of the things in the game is if you don't buy anything during the game, you get a bonus. And you can actually win the game by not spending any money.
By like, virtue alone.
Just like real life. Like you might be winning by not even walking in. Because it's like, yeah, I always go in and I spend so much, and I come home with like all these little stupid toys, and it's amazing.
And you get rid of the capsules as well, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think I won at least one round using that technique, so.
Oh, good, good.
It's quite challenging and cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think we've maybe talked at length here during our appetizer, but it's really fascinating to hear about New Mill and your journeys in Japan.
Yeah, we sort of tangented into one of our other topics there. And I had been wanting to talk to you a little bit about the indie game Night Market. Mm-hmm. Perhaps if we have time later, we can slot that in. But we are running long already, so perhaps we'll jump over to the main course. Okay. So yeah, jumping over to our main, we had actually had a game that both other Daniel and I have both been playing, so I thought we'd get into detail with, and that is Hades 2. So, I mean, we were just talking last episode. We did cover the original Hades game very early in the podcast with special guest Quinn Brander. And if you go back and listen to that, episode 30, I think it was. And we've been meaning to cover the sequel for a while. It has been in early access for some time, but it's recently hit 1.0. So just some information there. It is developed and published by Supergiant Games, directed by Greg Kasavin. And released September 25th, 2025. So, I mean, Daniel, did you want to kick us off here and just describe a little bit your experience with this game? What makes it Hades 2 different from the original?
So, I mean, when I first started it, I kind of downloaded it the first day it was available on the Switch, and it feels very much, if you like Hades, you'll like Hades 2. Like, it very much feels, especially at the beginning, just a continuation of the same ideas. But then you start getting some differences, right? Just in how the story structure is and the different abilities and such. But a lot of it does feel very familiar, and it's just as addictive as the original, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of new systems. One thing, just in the combat alone, there's the cast feature, I think, is one of the big ones, which is basically just create this circle around you that stops enemies from either leaving or entering that circle. So is this really helpful for crowd control, I found?
Oh, yeah.
You've got things like the overcharge, Omega, I think it's called, where you basically, right, every ability, your regular attack, your special attack, your cast, you can hold down the button and it sort of overcharges it. It will spend mana, which is a whole new currency, and that will sort of do a supercharge. It's completely different for every weapon. So those two things alone might not seem huge, but then you start adding in the way boons and other abilities will sort of cascade and synergize and combine those abilities in some fascinating ways. So just adding a couple of new mechanics does really blow open the number of ways you can be interacting with these systems.
What's funny, I guess I didn't even realize that those two things you mentioned were new. Like, they just felt so seamless, and it's been a while since I played the original, that it felt interesting. Okay.
Yeah, cast exists in the first game. And just to cover my perspective, I haven't played Hades 2 yet, primarily because I haven't beaten Hades 1 yet. Uh-huh. And I have dedicated a lot of time to it, so I'll be providing some color commentary or just poking out some questions. But I did play some other roguelite action games recently, including Hades 1, Rogue Legacy, and we have also covered the other kind of one that's in the conversation, Cult of the Lamb, in a previous episode as well. So those are kind of like food for thought. A rejoinder to Daniel's point is that cast did exist in Hades 1, but it was it behaved differently.
Okay.
So it was the one where you sent out the kind of the D10 or the D8 shaped orb, and it caused extra damage.
Okay.
Like one enemy that you kind of implanted the orb into.
Gotcha.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, so just, I mean, obviously, I know you've really enjoyed your time with this, Daniel, but I'm still struggling with this combat, I will say.
There is
a lot of things going on. Like, even with these more extra abilities stacked on, I really struggle to remember what boons and what abilities I've got at any particular time. Something about the angle, the perspective of this game is sort of coming at this diagonal, isometric thing. I just really struggle with reading the screen. There's projectiles all over the place. So, I mean, I think I'm just bad at this game. I've still not, like, beaten the main boss once. So, I don't know. I have been struggling with it a little bit. But, like, if you like that core system, I think what they've added here is really strong.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, I checked before recording, and it looks like I've played about 110 hours, which is a lot. And it did take me a while to get past the first boss, which was true in the first game also. Like, it took me a really long time to, like, figure out what I was doing enough to get past that first boss, and then I kind of sailed through the next couple without a whole lot of challenge. So it's interesting that it paralleled my experience with the first as well. I also found some weapons just worked better for me than others in this. There's one that you can actually use kind of rapid fire, and that I found to be the most useful for me, or the easiest to kind of get through it. In terms of, like, remembering the boons, I just don't worry about it. I just, like, oh, that sounds cool. And then once you play it a lot, you start kind of getting a knack for certain combinations of things when you're choosing them. But that can take a while. to kind of get that down.
It does feel like there's a lot more variance in sort of what will succeed and fail, just with there's so many different factors going into every run now.
Well, and then you probably have not unlocked, like, the different versions of the different weapons yet.
That's just it. I've heard so many features people talk about this game, and I'm like 20, 30 hours in that I've not seen.
I've heard
that there's pets. Yes. I heard that you can go up as well as down, and I have no idea how that happens. Like, there's romancing, apparently.
Yeah,
none of this I have experienced at all. So I have no idea how, like, I'm just taking my time with this one, I guess.
Yeah. No, there is a lot. And as soon as you think you've kind of unlocked it all, there's something else that'll open up for you. I had a slight advantage because my son was playing it as well, and he's a bit better at these kind of games than I am. So he was like, "Have you done this yet?" And I'm like, "What? No? That's a thing you could do?" He was like, yeah. So when I got to stuff that he hadn't done, that felt pretty good. I was like, "Oh, you haven't gone up yet? He's like, "No."
And yeah, you'll get that. A big draw of this game is the characters. And you're going to see a lot of returning faces here. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of new faces as well. I mean, I saw you recently talking about Nemesis as being a particular favorite of yours. I don't know if there's any other standouts for you.
Man, the writing in this game is just so good. And, like, I just like everybody. It's like, just, they're so good at kind of detailed character just through dialogue. But yeah, Nemesis is great. Eris is ridiculous. Morose is fun. I don't know. There's like, you're making me want to play the game again just to hang out with those characters.
You know, that's one thing that might seem kind of a little heretical coming from me, but, you know, I'm playing through Hades 1 again. It's been a little while since I kind of went serious at it. And because of, like, whatever platform I bought the game on, I basically, like, lost many hours of my save. So I'm back on Switch this time around. And I'm playing through it again. And the writing is great. The art is obviously top-notch. They're kind of those classic characters that you run into, you know, Athena and Artemis and Zeus, of course. All that familiar bunch. But this time around, I gotta say that I'm not really latching on to the story as much. I find that I'm just, like, skipping through a lot of the dialogue, probably because I have seen a lot of these earlier scenes before. But I'm not really, like, loving the relationship building, just kind of giving the standard, what is it, the drink, the gods,
the nectar, the nectar
that they love. It just seems like such a shallow mechanism compared to other kind of relationship building games that it's just not catching me this time. And I know I'm just going to get flamed on this because the characters and romancing them is such a huge part of this for a lot of people.
I mean, you like what you like, you know. I wouldn't fault you for it, but no, I enjoy it. It's very light, and you kind of bring to it what you want to bring to it, I think.
I do find myself agreeing with Mark a bit there, to be honest, because there's so much dialogue in this game. Like,
there's
that's one thing. Like, and it's incredibly dynamic too. Every time you run into a god, they'll comment on the boss that just killed you, or the previous god that you just spoke to and gave you a boon. And there's a lot of back and forth and sort of dynamic insertion dialogue that you'll never see the same thing twice. There's just so many permutations in this game. I do find a lot of it to be a bit flat. I mean, these Greek gods, by definition, are sort of stuck in this state of limbo and sort of arrested development. Like, nothing can ever change, really. They're always providing commentary, and it's sort of very flavorful, well-written, very expressive dialogue, but it is always just commentary. Here's your boon in a funny way, and then, like, there's never that relationship never changes in a sense, really. And I mean, I've been hearing people talking about, like, this sort of coffee shop AU fan fiction trend, and it does feel a little bit like that. Like, oh, here's your order of Poseidon's boon, have a good day, sort of. Like, that's as deep as the relationship ever gets, in a sense.
The one interesting point I thought about the relationship building is that some of this mythology has built in relationships already, if you know the mythology well enough. So the one interesting point I ran into recently was Zeus and Poseidon. The Zeus and Poseidon are brothers, right? So I just naturally, through the course of a run, I got a Zeus boon right away. And then later on, it generally gives you the option, this god or that god.
Yeah.
And I saw Poseidon's trident come up, and I'm like, that one, because I know they're brothers and they, like, famously hate each other or try and one-up each other. And I was rewarded knowing that. I mean, anyone who watches, like, whatever that a YA novel about the
young, like Percy Jackson?
Percy Jackson or whatever, knows the relationship. But especially, but if you remember your classics, you remember it too. But I was rewarded with dialogue and hopefully maybe mechanically a boon that was better than normal. It said, oh, yeah, I noticed that you tried to get something off my brother. I'm going to one-up him and give you something really good. So that aspect of it was really nice. Yeah, are the characters from Hades 2 more obscure than the kind of the classic famous gods that we all know?
Most of them are the same, I think. Oh. It's some of the minor characters are a little more obscure.
Yeah, like I guess Arachne. Right. I mean, Echo Narcissus. And Narcissus. Yeah. Some of those. Like the encounters you come across in the middle of a run, basically. Right. Like Sisyphus in the first game.
Right.
The B-tier gods.
Yeah. Which is some of my favorite moments in the game, I will say. Like, absolutely. Those are somewhere where you do see development over the course of the game. Like, and you can sort of complete a sort of sense of progression with them, like Sisyphus in the original. And here, Arachne has this very combative view of the gods, obviously. And there is a real sense of character development as you encounter her each time. So that's one of my favorite moments, I will say. And like, similarly to, who were the two in the original game that were singing?
Orpheus.
And yes, Orpheus and
Eurydice. Psyche? Eurydice. Yeah.
And that was my favorite moment from the original.
There is a similar interaction with Narcissus and Echo, where you're trying to kind of work on their relationship, which is kind of funny. So yeah, no, I think there are moments with those more minor characters that you're trying to help them solve their problems. And even some of the folks in the Crossroads, you know, like, because several of them are related to each other. They're all like children of Nyx, the goddess of night.
Right.
So there's some interesting kind of social dynamics between those. But with the gods giving you the boons, it's a very transactional relationship. And you don't, there isn't a whole lot. There are definitely a lot of Easter eggs if you know Greek mythology, right? With the interaction of the gods. There's a lot of things that play off of that. Some of them more subtle than others. The character Dora
who I'm assuming is Pandora. There's gonna be some.
I'm not gonna tell you who it is. I was surprised and then annoyed that I didn't figure it out.
Pandora the Explorer.
Yeah, there you go. So there are lots of little. If you know your Greek mythology, there's lots of little fun kind of Easter eggy stuff.
Yeah, I did just have Moros show up, and there's been some back and forth discussions as the children of Nyx. So
yeah,
I am starting to see some progression. But when I hear you say 110 hours, I just feel exhausted. Okay. I don't know.
So yeah, a lot of that is obsessive. So what happens is you start getting those kind of the fated list. Like the checklist stuff.
Yeah,
I need to do them, and so I'll just keep doing runs to try to get specific boons.
Tick boxes.
Exactly. And it's that like little bit of, if I don't currently have a day job, so I'm often left with not much to do during the day, and not many goals that I can like cross off my list, and that fills that way too well. So it was a lot of just like playing the game to feel some sense of progression. Even though it was just in a game and not.
Isn't that video games for a lot of us?
Absolutely.
Like, isn't that why we play games? Is like, even if, you know, whatever, if your career is in a rut or whatever, like in video games, you can always get over the hurdle.
Absolutely.
Like, for the most part.
Yeah. And the Hades games do that extremely well, because you can do like, even when you're doing a full run, it's maybe like an hour, right, to get through the whole run. But then you feel this sense of accomplishment, even though it's really artificial. And then it goes, well, I have time to do another one. I'll just do another run. Oh, let me see if I can get this boon this time, right?
I think the smart innovation with Hades, and I'm saying this in comparison to some other of those action roguelikes I was mentioning, is that like there are like, it's kind of like tiered progress.
Oh yeah.
Obviously, it's a roguelite, so you do get the persistent benefits. But compared to something like Rogue Legacy, I don't know if either of you guys have played that one.
A little bit.
But in that one, like they kind of front load the roguelite randomization. So the premise is that you have this is like Castlevania, except you play every generation within a family trying to take down Dracula, essentially. So you go into a castle, the castle is randomly reshapen magically, and you play the descendant of lord or lady whatnot. And this time you're a honking like brute, or this time you're a very slight, agile ninja, or whatever. And so that's really where the interest comes in. But all the interest comes in at the beginning, and then you just try and last as long as you can. And a run might take 20 minutes, it might take 5 minutes, because you just die. The action is hard enough. But in Hades, and I presume Hades 2, you're doled out the progress, because every level, essentially, you're getting a new choice, a new upgrade, and you're getting to develop your character into a direction slowly, bit by bit. So you feel that intermediate progress along the way.
Mm-hmm. If it compared to something like satisfying. Binding of Isaac, which is an old favorite of mine, but even though you were getting upgrades over the course of the run, that was always like completely randomized. Like, well, this is the one upgrade for this level. But in Hades, you are always being given a choice. Like, which of these two paths do you want to go down? Which of these three boons do you want to choose? And so there is a better sense of crafting a build, as it were. There is going to be a lot of luck as it goes into it. And I don't always feel that I can get a good grasp of what synergizes together necessarily. Mm-hmm. A lot of trial and error. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of depth to plunge there.
I mean, Slay the Spire is another one that does a very similar kind of thing, right? Where you're building your characters, you go and you're kind of making simple choices.
Choose one of these three cards.
Right. That's probably the closest comparison for stuff that I've played. But there's something just, I don't know. There's a lot more in Hades, I think, that scratches that itch for me.
Yeah, you're right. Overall, though, like, it's got the individual levels, and then you make one character generating choice. And at the end of a sequence, you get the boss, and then you move up to another tier. So, yeah, I think that parallel works really well between Hades and...
Yeah, structurally, like, very basic structure. I think they're actually quite similar.
A couple of aesthetic elements I just wanted to touch on is that, like, obviously this is an incredibly beautiful game with all this 2D animation, and what they've added here is this almost sort of holographic sheen over everything. It almost looks like the sort of Magic the Gathering foiling you get on the cards, where there's this shine. I don't know how they do that exactly, but that's quite effective. And the music also. I mean, Darren Korb is probably my favorite musician in games. I just continue to love all of that. There's some really great tracks here. So I do appreciate all the aesthetics in this game is just incredible. Yeah, even though I'm not... I'm still feeling a little cynical on just the overall structure of roguelikes in general, I think.
I'm not that into roguelikes generally. There's just something about this game that really does it for me.
Yeah, I think the tight action is really what it hinges upon, because I don't know if you guys would agree, but some games, roguelites, seem to at least balance two spheres, let's just call it, for another lack of a better term. In Hades, the majority of the game is mostly devoted to the action. Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. But then there's other games like Cult of the Lamb, where the activity of what you do is more divided equally. So in Cult of the Lamb, it's the action is one part, and the other part is your kind of town building, cult building aspect. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit more bifurcated that way. And I always felt that the weakness of Cult of the Lamb is that the action is not as tight as Hades. Mm-hmm. The action is not as satisfying as Hades. And the town building is not terribly deep compared to other dedicated town builders. So kind of like, pick a lane, guys.
Yeah, I tried Cult of the Lamb. I had that same issue where, the action wasn't as great, and then the town building wasn't very compelling to me. Then I kind of bounced off it after a few hours.
Yeah, ago, other roguelites like Loop Hero is one that I played, and Daniel, I know you've been playing. Sorry, Daniel Winter, I know that you've been playing Ball Pit, right? You said
yeah,
that secondary mode.
Well, that's one I've been really getting into lately. I've still been like picking at like one game at a time. I played a session just before we recorded here, but the big draw of that is that a run is 15 minutes, and like I get in, I get my fix, and I'm done. Whereas like Hades, a good run is like an hour, and I see so many people say, "Oh, it's only half an hour." Like I'm not seeing that. Like half an hour to die to Scylla or something maybe, but a good run takes time to build up, and I just don't have sort of patience for roguelikes taking that much time to get through, and sort of the running through the permutations, is this going to be a good gamble of a run or not? I don't know, that's not much of a draw for me anymore.
So in Hades 2, is the bulk of the action like 75% more still the action gameplay?
Yeah, I mean there is a lot of things to do in the crossroads, I guess it's called. Yeah, a lot of upgrades. There's always too many, I think. There's like 12 currencies, and a lot of them feel arbitrary in sort of what you're upgrading. So I think I just go to the pot. What can I upgrade this time? Okay, fine, that'll do. I guess I've got a new pool of health I can find sometimes now.
wait till you start decorating.
Oh, no.
It's a whole other thing that, yeah, you don't really need to do, but it winds up opening up dialogue options. Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot. And there's a lot of dialogue. I feel like you spend a lot of time just walking around talking to everybody between every run, which I enjoy, but it was, yeah, sometimes it's a lot.
Yeah, I guess some people, some audience members are taking that as the reward for grinding through all the action is getting more relationship stuff.
Yeah, they want the story.
And I suppose, like, you can, other than the ones that require currency to unlock, you can get more dialogue by just kind of dying sooner. Mm-hmm. Just going back to the town.
Although sometimes if you die too fast, they have nothing to say. Like, there hasn't been enough times, but that's rare.
And they do, like, it does feed into each other in this way. Like, the more you die, the more you'll be fed these upgrades that will make the runs a little easier. There is also the I think it's called God mode or something. Mode, yeah. That is basically does make the game. It's like an easy mode, essentially. I've not messed with that. I haven't quite taken that hit to my my reputation just yet. But I don't know. I feel like you want to do that if you're just in it for the story. I'm not enjoying that enough either. So yeah.
I got stuck in, like, the boss fight or one of the later bosses. And I just could not get past it. And I was like banging my head against it. And somebody was like, you could turn on God mode. I'm like, oh, right. And I did that. And then I got past it and I was fine. And then I just kept it on because at that point, like, yeah, it's just fun to go farther.
You could probably breeze through it faster that way as well, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because, like, what it does is it reduces the amount of damage you take in attacks. So
it does feel like damage is pretty tanky. Like, I mean, you take a lot of damage. Like, it's easy to go from full to zero in not much time at all in those later levels.
Yeah. Especially if you haven't, like, fully upgraded certain keepsakes or tarot cards. Like, there's ways to kind of improve that. And when you get the familiars, there's, like, five different animals. And those all give you different bonuses. So, like, there's ways to augment all that stuff. And that's kind of the roguelike part of it, right? Is these kind of semi-permanent things that you can kind of trade in and out to kind of give your character some advantages. And that helps some of that. But yeah, early on, you just get beat up over and over and over again. So God mode does help on that front.
I might try that. I'm not sure. I might be done with this. I'm not sure. I mean, I will say as a final word, what I found, a character that I found is completely representative of my experience with this game is Scylla.
Scylla,
yeah. Who, like, the famous siren from the Odyssey, who is, like, one of the most original takes on a Greek character. Like, basically, she's, like, she and the other sirens are in this rock band with a Midwestern accent, and they're constantly introducing new songs as you go along. But also the fact that as you're going through her level, you hear the song in the distance gradually getting louder and louder the closer you get to her, which is, there's so many fantastic design touches in how they handled that level and her character. And I have died to her so many times. Like, yeah. I've only gotten past her, like, twice. I don't know. That is just a huge roadblock for me.
You got to take out the drummer first. That's
and I'm a little bit tired of hitting that, of hitting my head against that wall, to be honest. So I don't know. Do you have any final word on it, Daniel?
Oh, I don't have anything else to say about it. I really enjoyed it. It really was satisfying to me for what I needed out of it, I think, is what I'm saying. And maybe that's a part of my enjoyment, is that I'm not looking for anything too deep with it. Like, I enjoyed Hades for what it was. I enjoyed this for what it is. I got a lot. I mean, obviously, I played for over 100 hours, so I was getting something out of it. But yeah, I don't know. It's just, like, it's a very addictive structure for my brain, I guess, is really what it is.
You said you put in over 100 hours, Daniel Newman, to Hades 2. Did you also put a similar amount in for number one?
Oh, way more, because I think I probably did, like, three separate games to completion. Oh. And it's just, yeah, it's the dopamine from completing tasks that just really does it for me. I used to play World of Warcraft too, and not with other people, just, like, give me a quest so I can finish it, and then I'll feel good about finishing that quest. So it does a very similar thing.
Number go up.
Exactly. Oh, I get a check mark make me feel good.
I mean, there absolutely is something to be said about having a game that you can just return to and know what you're going to get each run. I mean, we see people playing just Fortnite or Roblox and having the game that they play, and this is always going to give you a somewhat consistent experience with a slightly different tweak every time.
As long as I was uncovering something new, I got to the point. The reason I stopped playing Hades was because I just didn't feel like I was making any forward progress. Like, I still have a handful of things on that list that I could check off, but it's just not worth it. It's, like, down to random number generator, whether I'll get the one boon I need. I'm just like, this isn't fun anymore. It's just frustrating. So I'll play for an hour and not accomplish the one thing I was trying to do. So I was like, okay, I'm done. But it took me a few I'm done's to actually be done.
Right. It's like collecting baseball cards, right? Uh-huh. Like the first 80% is really easy to get, relatively speaking, and it's the last 20 that is you have to really tease out with difficulty. That makes a lot of sense. Makes me think that roguelikes have different hooks and levers and incentives for pulling different types of players in. Sounds like we're all slightly different players, but we've all enjoyed this game and games like it to various degrees. And you're constantly fed rewards in exchange for effort and persistence. Because one thing you can say about these games is that you have to come back. If you don't come back, then the game is over.
Right.
You have to agree to hit that Sisyphean task again. That's what I actually most relate with Sisyphus in Hades 1 anyways. Like, why is he not the star? Because it feels like you're Sisyphus time you have to tackle it again.
Well, and it's really clever that, like, you get an end credits maybe a third of the way through the game. Like, there's a lot of game left after you beat the game. And it just never ends, really. So you there's always a reason to go back and do some more stuff.
If a roguelike gives me an off-ramp, I will take it. I am so glad to be done with one and move on to the next game, to be honest.
So knowing when to quit and just, like, say I'm done. Like, you just have to declare it. There's no natural ending, which is how they got me to play for other times, I think. So.
Hey, any game you can put 100 hours in and walk away satisfied.
I got my money's worth for sure, yeah. And I probably will play it again at some point, like in the next year. I'll just pick it up, start over.
That's awesome.
So,
really good. Okay, I think we covered Hades 2 and action roguelites pretty well. What do you think we talk about a dessert, an off-topic topic soon?
Yeah, I think we've got a few things we wanted to discuss there. Daniel, why don't you kick us off with some dessert?
All right. So, in part of my newfound Japan culture obsession, I guess, over the last couple years... I'm not really an anime or manga person, and I never really have been. I've seen a couple things, like, back in the day, but it wasn't really anything that I got into. And then I discovered Junji Ito in the last couple years. It was a horror mangaka artist. And just fell in love with his just bizarre horror, like, comics. And I basically found and read everything I could get my hands on, including a new volume that just came out like this month, which I had no idea, or last month. So that was a good find. And then I also got into Chainsaw Man recently because I'd seen trailers for the movie that was in theaters. And I was like, this looks really weird. And I know nothing about it. And then I did a little research. Like, oh, I really should watch the 12 episode series first. So I did that in one evening. It's only about like 4 or 5 hours, but still, like, I just sat there and that's all I did for those 4 or 5 hours. And then I went to see the movie the next day in the theater. And then I ordered the box set of the first 11 books of the manga. And I'm working my way through that, about halfway through that now. And it's just so bizarre and great. And I don't know, I've just been loving it. I'm not necessarily looking for more manga to read, but I'm really enjoying the weirdness of this. My only other kind of current manga obsession is Kitaro, which is... from, oh god, like the 60s, I want to say, 60s and 70s.
It's a classic.
Yeah. And Shigeru Mizuki is the artist and writer, and did it for decades, was writing this. And what's cool is the books that you can get have like a little bit of the history, his history with this character, which comes from an earlier tradition of like paper models, like kind of like a puppet show, puppet theater.
Yeah, Kamishibai.
Yeah, thank you. I was blanking on the name. So that was really cool, like learning all the history. And then, yeah, he's a little boy who lives in a graveyard, and he's actually a yokai, and he solves problems that come up with other yokai. And it's just a really fun, really strange little piece of Japanese culture that I've been really enjoying.
Yeah, Junji Ito, I read quite a number of his books last year as part of a book club. I probably talked about them at some point on the podcast here, but it's such a fascinating exploration of just like mundane horror and really drawing out these horrific elements out of just, you know, very ordinary everyday experiences. Like, I think Mark, we were talking recently about his cat diary book and the horrifying experiences of being a cat owner. But I mean, I don't know if you had any particular highlights from his catalog, Daniel.
Oh man, I mean, There's so many stories. Like the balloon head one is great. Hmm. Where there are these balloons with people's faces that are floating around Tokyo, and if they catch you, they grab you and hang you, and then you're just floating around dead from this balloon, and it takes over the whole town. Bananas. There's one about an ice cream truck.
Huh.
I don't know if you know this one.
No.
Where, like, it lures the kids in to eat ice cream, but then they turn into ice cream. There's, like, talking about them just sounds like you're making things up as you go.
These concepts really do haunt you. Once you've experienced them, like, they will not leave your mind.
Yeah.
But they're kind of horrific in a different sense than traditional, like, kind of Western
for
horror.
Sure.
They're just kind of, like, off the wall and bizarre. Yeah. Mm. They remind me of, like you said, like, yokai myth. Mm-hmm. Which oftentimes, like, they're not trying to kill you and take you the blood from you. Sometimes they're just weird.
Yeah.
Like, they just, like, they have caused some weird effect, and they exist. I feel the same way about Junji Ito's stories, too. Is they're just, like, some weird brain fart.
Yes.
And he comes up with these stories, he gets them out, and his art is great.
Yes.
So kudos there. But oftentimes they're just super non sequiturs.
Yes.
Narratively speaking.
He often doesn't finish them either. They come to some sort of stop, but it's not really the end of the story, right? And I think a lot of them, I've read a little bit about his process or whatever. A lot of them are dreams. He has some weird idea and then he kind of carries it out. Or he just has a random thought, like, what would happen if somebody turned into ice cream? That would be weird. Let me write a story about it. And they're all, they're very kind of mundane. They're not monsters, really. They're often very human stories. And, but the yokai, I was going to say. There are yokai that's like, there's one that's just a giant wall, an invisible wall. Because if you're ever walking somewhere and you feel like you can't move forward, it's probably this yokai that is this big wall that you can't see.
Yeah, or if you want a kind of like a fairly easy introduction to yokai, the Yokai Watch, the cartoon, is actually a pretty good introduction. There's a video game series of the same name, both created by Level 5, which is this famed video game development studio out of Japan. They created the Ni no Kuni series, if you're familiar with that. Yokai Watch is actually, it's for kids. It's essentially like another kind of Pokemon, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. But the cartoon ended up being like a all ages phenomenon across Japan. I think it still is, if I'm not mistaken. But it covers all yokai, gotta catch 'em all style.
That's awesome.
It's quite good.
Yeah, Shigeru Mizuki actually put out a book, an illustrated book about yokai that I picked up this summer, which is very cool. So like it's in his style that he did Kitaro, but it's just like full color illustrations and descriptions of all these different yokai, which is very neat.
Yeah, the Shigeru Mizuki work that I'm most familiar with is, if you're a history fan, he created this like 4 or 5 volume piece called Showa, which is essentially the history of the 20th century from his perspective. And like you said, with the Kitaro books, he kind of weaves in his biography into it. And he's a war veteran. Mm-hmm. Obviously for the Japanese side in the what they call the Great Pacific War, which was World War II. And he basically, every chapter is alternating between like his life growing up as a kid pre-war to like history, fact about World War II and or leading up to it, and then back to his story and then back to history. And it's really, you can't put it down. Like Showa, it's in 4 volumes. You got to check it out.
Yeah, I'm writing it down because that sounds amazing.
Yeah, super worthwhile and when well-researched.
Awesome.
Very cool. Mark, do you want to continue on with your dessert course?
Yeah, happy to say. I'll just say that I'm also reading Chainsaw Man. Haven't seen the movie yet, but I would love to see it if anyone wants to go.
It's really
watch
good.
It with me
it's
locally.
Really good.
That would be cool. I kind of fell off around chapter 100. You know, there's that big shift in the story
perspective. I haven't gotten there yet. I'm at like chapter 40.
Okay.
I haven't actually read past the movie yet. Cause so like the TV series is the first like 4 books, like the first 30 something chapters. And then I guess the Reza arc kind of picks up immediately after that, which is what the movie's based on. And I haven't gotten past that, but I heard it gets very strange once you get past all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff you're mentioning is really the off the wall stuff, which I love to hear.
Yeah,
it's the kind of the non typical stuff, so that's really cool. Chainsaw Man is very kind of non typical, for sure. Okay, the one I'll mention briefly is also Japanese, which is kind of standard. Everyone's groaning. I always mention Japanese inspired or Japanese related stuff, but this is based on something that I watched in my youth. I'm talking about the latest Kamen Rider series. So Kamen Rider is a long-running TV show in Japan, ostensibly for kids, but nowadays it's more for adults, kind of like Transformers is, let's be honest, in the Western market. So Zetz is what it's called, Z-E-Z-T-Z, which is really easy to spell, obviously. It's the 40th series in this long-running series. Started in 1971. And basically, if you haven't seen it, this is like great for fans of like Power Rangers. It's of a subgenre of Japanese TV called tokusatsu, which is like live action, usually with dudes in kind of like lycra suits. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of explosions, like literal explosions. If you recall Power Rangers, the early episodes, mm-hmm. they're just blowing up stuff every episode. And in this one, what it adds is motorbikes. So Kamen Rider is called Kamen Rider because Kamen means mask. And he rides a cool souped up motorcycle and he punches guys. So it's not much more complex than that. Well, at least to start. This one is kind of like postmodern. They're really trying to weave between like the original child audience, because this entire series has existed only to sell toys mm-hmm. for the past 45 years or so. And but nowadays a lot of the fan base is older, so I think it's like skews a little bit older than I recall. The premise is that the main hero is an unlikely hero. He doesn't have like strength on his side. I think he's like a hikikomori. He like lives mm-hmm. at home, doesn't work, he just sleeps his days away. And what he does is he ends up like fighting evil in his dreams. and then one time he saves a child from a car accident and he ends up fighting off this evil force in his dream. And then he ends up and he has the famous Kamen Rider belt, which helps him transform. So he goes into the premises, he goes into his dream every episode and fights off this evil force, which is affecting people in the real world. He is supported by his perfect little sister who cares for him deeply. His parents are not around. I don't know what's up there. He's assisted by a transforming motorcycle. So the motorcycle is not just a souped up motorcycle, but he transforms into this humanoid, which is actually a really cool suit if you want to see that. Obviously really cool suits.
Magical girl transformation.
Yeah. Terrible CG. I got into this genre before CG. It's always been super cheesy, whether you like the CG or not. It's basically like 90s PlayStation level CG sure. we're talking about here, but still really fun. Anyways, lots of combat, lots of kooky, melodramatic plot lines. If this all sounds right to you, like it's still hitting all those points. It's going to appeal to the kid in you if you have that spirit in you. If you're a fan of Power Rangers, you'll probably enjoy this. And get this, it's carrying on the tradition of trying to sell you toys. His belt, he gains new abilities literally by plugging in gachas. He gets new power-ups by getting gachas from a machine.
That's amazing.
In his headquarters, and he plugs it into his belt and he has a new ability. So hey, unreal. Kids, you I can gain it. Those powers too if you hit those gacha machines.
Buy more gacha.
So yeah, great.
I'm not familiar with that series at all, Mark, but I know there was a new movie out a couple of years ago by Hideki Anno. Kamen Rider. Have you seen that?
I have watched the first like 20 minutes of it. But yeah, that was following along the tradition of like Shin Gojira as yes. well, too, right? These kind of reinterpretations of basically rubber suits. Action series of the 60s and 70s, which is essentially the roots of tokusatsu. So mm-hmm. obviously these great Japanese creators grew up with that sort of stuff. So I can only imagine that was Hideki Anno jumping at the chance to be involved in the Kamen Rider series. Yeah, I need to watch that one because it's presumably a darker twist on the series.
Most likely. Okay. I mean, I had a Japanese recommendation last week, but I'm going to break the formula here today. I had another final horror film. I know I've been coming in with a lot of recommendations over October, which is now over, but I did squeeze in a couple more at the end there. A film that my wife and I literally watched on Halloween evening called Pontypool. And this is a 2008 film directed by Bruce McDonald. It's a Canadian film set in Ontario. And I heard this buzz that it was basically a zombie film from the perspective of a radio DJ, like experiencing the zombie apocalypse from the perspective of being live on the radio, essentially. And it's definitely this layer of sort of War of the Worlds, hearing about everything secondhand. And it has this really good job of sort of playing with our expectations. Like we can all picture what a zombie apocalypse looks like, plays with those expectations, and you lets your imagination do the rest as you hear these stories coming in over the radio. That's all done really well, except it's not even the most interesting part of this film. And like, I don't even want to really spoil it, but like, zombie fiction has become so obsessed with the mode of transmission. Mm-hmm. Like, we've got all of these, oh, it's a rabies virus that makes everyone really, really angry. Oh, it's the cordyceps in The Last of Us. And this takes that in a completely different direction that is much weirder and like more unknowable, almost this sort of cosmic horror. I don't want to spoil it, but it's mm-hmm. really fascinating, plays with some really sci-fi elements that I've been really interested in, and like ways that brains can be rewritten in some fascinating ways. So yeah, really, really clever, unique. It's hard to do a unique zombie film these days. So highly recommend Pontypool.
Yeah, I'll plus one that. I've seen it as well. It's super, super good. A bit of a slow burn.
Yeah.
Especially at the beginning.
It's confusing. It plays your head in some really fascinating ways that I'll have to rewatch it mm-hmm. and to recalibrate what it is I saw and heard. It is one where the first time in a long time where I felt compelled to go out and find the book immediately. So I'm going to have to track that down.
Very cool.
Got to say, when you started off with Bruce McDonald, that's the most Canadian sounding name. Actually, maybe like only second to like Gordon McDonald. That sure. would be like
or Gordon Lightfoot. So we've got a little bit of time. Daniel, I know that you've been watching a lot of movies yourself, including some horror films. I was curious if you had any recommendations there.
Oh, so I decided at the beginning of this year that I was going to go to the movie theater as much as I possibly could. It was one of the things I missed the most from COVID lockdowns, which I know is a while ago now, but we'll never be rid of that, I suppose. And I have been to the movies 86 times as of yesterday, October 31st, or the November... Yeah, whatever yesterday was. I've seen a lot. Yeah, that's a lot of movies. Recently, actually, the last movie I saw in the theater was the Back to the Future 40th anniversary release on IMAX. And I don't think I'd ever... It was a movie that I'd seen as a kid dozens of times on VHS. I don't think I'd ever seen it in the theater. And it was almost like watching it for the first time. Like,
did they put a lot of work into like remastering it?
I assume. You know, I didn't look into it that much. but just the fact that it was so big and watching it as an adult, having not seen it for a long time, just lots of details that I missed, you know, as a kid. Subtleties that I was able to pick up on. So that was kind of fascinating. God, I would have to look at my... Hold on a second. Let me pull up.
I mean, I went through a period before I moved to Canada where I was going to the cinema once or twice a week with friends. And that's such a fun memory. It's such a cool part of my life that I really wish I could get back to, especially seeing a movie with friends and being able to immediately talk about it afterwards. I now have a 5-year-old who you can probably hear thumping around upstairs. I've been to the movie, probably 5 times in the last 5 years, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, so I signed up for... So we have AMC theaters. I don't know where you are. It's this big movie chain. And in New York City, there's like a half dozen of them around the city. And I can go to the movies 4 times in a week for $30 a month. And I don't have a day job right now. So I've just been going as many times as I can per week. And it's just been crazy. Okay, so the last movie I saw that I would highly recommend is Begonia, which is the newest from Yorgos Lanthimos, who did Lobster and The Favorite. And a bunch of poor things, I think.
Right, last year, still I need to check that out. Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Also, Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein was fantastic. Those are probably the top two of the last month or so. One Battle After Another, also fantastic. That's still in theaters, I think.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to catching Frankenstein. I was planning to watch that on Halloween, but apparently it's not on Netflix for another
No, I think the 7th so. It comes to yeah. Netflix. Yeah, it was very limited theatrical release. And then, yeah, Netflix. But no, I really enjoyed that one.
Excellent. I think we've lost Mark. Are you there? Nope.
All right. Sorry about that. There was a technical issue on my end, but we're catching up after hearing Daniel Newman's movie recommendations. Super jealous. I wish I could see more films in the cinema like you have. I think it's kind of good for the soul. It costs a lot of money, but sounds like you got a good solution where you are.
Yeah. I mean, the concessions are still killing me. but yeah, that's how they get you. They give you the movies for free, and then you spend so much money on chicken tenders and Nerds gummy clusters. But that's my fault.
Popcorn to watch a movie. It's a law.
We'll have that poison.
All right. We should. We had a great conversation, so we should probably wrap it up there. What do you think, Daniel Winter?
Yes, Ted, the cat is circling, so I think it's the alarm is sounding. Time to start wrapping it up. if you have any questions or comments for us today, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
Yep, and if you want to catch our videos on YouTube, you can watch them there if you haven't yet. And our older episodes are available only in audio form on a podcatcher of your choosing. We love to hear your feedback on any platform. Love to hear your emails as well. Basically, we don't have any ads or anything for the show. We do it for the love. So hearing your feedback gives us the inspiration to carry on and to produce more episodes. So you can email us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com. And you can catch us on social media. We have an official Omnigamers Club channel on Blue Sky. I'm on Blue Sky as well as MarkYuasa at bsky.social.
Yep, you can find me at Board Game Feast over at Blue Sky, along with our Omnigamers Club account there as well. Daniel Newman, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm also on Blue Sky at DNLNWMN. That's my name without vowels.
That's right. And of course, listeners can check out NewMillIndustries.com, where all of Daniel Newman's older games and newer upcoming games are visible to be seen, and games from other designers as well, perhaps from Japan and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'll drop the link to that in the show notes. And obviously also check out the Indie Game Night Market coming up at PAX Unplugged. We didn't get a chance to talk about it in detail, but I know you won't be there in person this year.
I will not. It's the same weekend as Tokyo Game Market, makes me very sad, because I'm really going to miss being there to see all the cool stuff that folks are going to have to sell.
Yeah, I'm going to be missing PAX Unplugged this year as well for the first time in a few years. But sad to be missing it, but I really had a blast at the Indie Night Market last year. And a quick plug from me, if you happen to be in the Vancouver area, coming up this weekend, November 7th through 9th, we have ProtoCon, a new convention here in Vancouver, basically based on the game design, playtesting. But entirely playtesting. I think there's something like 50 different designs coming in here to be playtested, and that's the entire thing. You can go in as a just an attendee and try a bunch of new games, help some designers playtest their game and polish them off. So that's awesome. I'm really excited to check that out, hoping it's the first of many, and excited to see what we find. Vancouver has a really strong game design scene here, so if you're in the area, definitely check that out.
You're here. Excited to see more indie games coming out of Vancouver. And someone in my household is starting to have a shower, so I'm going to have to sign off sooner than later. Thank you so much, Daniel Newman, for being on the show.
Thanks for joining us.
Great conversation.
It was a blast. Thanks for having me on.
Fantastic. All right. Well, everyone out there still listening, thanks for listening. And of course, until next time, have a balanced diet of games.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.